Why are so many dogs suffering from health issues? Actress Katherine Heigl, who's helped save over 16,000 dogs through her foundation, says she's seeing more issues with dogs' joints, odors, and health than ever before. And after doing a ton of research, she feels there's one place we can look to support any dog's health: their food. So she decided to create something she could actually feel good about feeding her dogs. It's called Superfood Complete. Superfood Complete is made with over 30 of the healthiest ingredients on the planet, including several superfoods vital to your dog's health. Badlands Ranch also sponsors the Jason Debus Heigl Foundation, which has helped rescue thousands of dogs and place them in loving homes. Dogs across America are trying this food and experiencing amazing health benefits. Go to badlandsranch.com/save50 and order right now to get up to 50% off your regular price order with a 90-day money-back guarantee. If you want your dog to experience all these incredible things, go to badlandsranch.com/save50 today.
Hey everyone, thanks for tuning into Power Athlete Radio. How can I sum up this episode? Well, Brett Bartholomew is basically in the driver's seat of a vision quest to be the best coach, person, leader, human, whatever you want to be. The author of Conscious Coaching does allow for the typical power athlete detours to occur along the way, which obviously include movies, politics, child rearing, and of course, well-born stories. It's the guidance that you've been looking for from a guy who has done a ton of research. Here it is, episode 570. Going down the
road. That's how I got my start in photoshopping. As the story goes, and I've told it on this podcast before, I had, you know, the only thing I used the computer for was booking travel when I was an NFL player. I didn't use the computer. I didn't get online. I just fucking read books and thought I lifted weights and had this like cool idea that I was gonna be Qui-Gon Cain just wandering the fucking earth. And so then I get out of the NFL and I get into this whatever the fuck we do now, and I needed to jump on the computer and had zero skills. And all of a sudden I got this email that was addressed to me and CC'd like 150 people of me and like photoshopped into a body of water with a dolphin blowing a load on my face.
What? Just yeah. Happened.
Just fucking out of nowhere. My buddy, Bryant, I'm not going to say his last name. He just sends this to me and then CC'd like hundreds of people, like many of which I didn't even know. And they were just responding like, this is the funniest thing. And I was like, like I'd always been able to defend myself anywhere I've ever been. Never had a problem throwing hands. And I realized I was getting slapped around like a little bitch. Yeah. So I hit up Joey, who was a designer buddy of mine. And I was like, Joey, get over here. How do I defend myself? So he came over. I downloaded Illustrator, Photoshop on my laptop, and he showed me a few things. I'm like, well, how many hours do I need before I'm actually good enough to defend myself? And he's like, I don't know, like 100? No problem. So I basically started Photoshopping 18 hours a day for like 6 days. All I did was just fucking Photoshop things. I used to hit people up. I'm like, you need anything Photoshopped? And just did a million different things. And by the end of 100
hours. That's an incredible amount of dicks.
At the end of 100 hours, I was well skilled. And then I just started a fucking daily barrage of like that CC to that person, just murdering him in any way I could.
And you know who else is deadly with the Photoshop? 50 Cent, when he was going through all the people with like Jadakiss and Ja Rule and all that. Every day, this dude would have like just something that was so ridiculous. Even the, like the old Piggy Bank video, if you remember that song, if you guys are hip hop heads at all, like the animations that they did making fun of everybody he was, you know, in a beef with at that time was great. And now, unfortunately, we don't have that in hip hop. We have Lil Uzi Vert and Lil Pump. You know, and the competitive nature has been taken out of it, which is very sad.
I feel like hip hop died.
I think there's some people keeping it alive. I don't think it's like died until like mumble rappers are the only things left on this planet. You know, they're still, but yes, I get it. Yeah. Rap and hip hop are different though. Rap and hip hop are as different as like strength and conditioning and, you know, people using the fitness moniker and not everybody, right? It would be something below fitness because there are good coaches that focus on fitness and what you, but you get what I mean, right? Like people that are like, I'm a trainer and they're not anything. They don't do any of that.
Well, I mean, wasn't kind of rap and hip hop synonymous for a long time? I mean,
well, hip hop is like the movement. Hip hop is like the whole thing. If you listen to one of my favorite movies is, we actually had Ali Kirshner, who's on our team, watch it last night because it's part of like onboarding. It's called From Something to Nothing, The Art of Rap. And it's an Ice-T film. And he goes and kind of talks to like everybody from Big Daddy Kane to Eminem to Kanye to, you know, Salt-N-Pepa to MC Light about what their process was like rapping. Because I'm a huge hip hop head. It got me through when I was hospitalized. And you know, one of the guys explains it really well. He's like, hip hop is the movement in its entirety. Not everybody in hip hop is a real like lyricist and artist. You have some people that are just kind of rappers. And you see that now, right? A lot of these people think they can rap. But if you were to watch like BET's The Cypher and you watch kind of the, you know, the people that are maybe in it just because they have good production and good beats, they're not going to be in it long, you know, every day. Sure. But yeah. It's interesting to hear how that culture describes itself of like being different than hip hop and rap and training and working out. You kind of see a lot of parallels in hip hop. I would say the one biggest thing, and then I'll shut up. But the biggest thing is we're watching this. We're hearing all these hip hop artists talk about who they were influenced by. So Redman's like, man, for me, it was like the syllable sound combined of Big Daddy Kane and Tretch by Naughty by Nature. And they're very good at like acknowledging who they're inspired by. Sure. Whereas in strength and conditioning, right? It's like, no, this guy sucks. That guy sucks. And like,
I disagree, man. But maybe I come at it from a different place in that I've always felt that we stand on the shoulders of giants. That
no, I'm saying a lot other people in our industry don't. I don't think a lot of people in our industry don't give credit.
Well, that's the number one easy way to know that somebody's a fraud.
Right.
Is when they start basically, I'm like, yeah, you can only rip off so much Franz Bosch as your own. I'd like it disgusts me, or Cal Dietz or whatever. I mean, it's, you know, I'm like, it's like I shake my head at least 10 times a day and, you know, see different things on Instagram. I'm like, oh, yeah, no, I read that book too.
And right. So what I mean is, why do you think that's a different? Why do you think that's different? What I was saying is in strength and conditioning, we don't give enough credit to other people why for inspiring that? Us.
It's because
it's an insecure field.
Yeah. No, I was like, I think if in like in a lot of people's minds who are frauds, if they actually point to like, hey, this is where I got this information, it's somehow they feel like it diminishes what they do. Whereas I look at it like, dude, I stand on the shoulders of giants. I'm more than happy to talk about, you know, Franz Bosch or Charlie Francis or where this came from or these pieces and how we assembled everything. And, you know, nobody's created anything. And the people that have deserve to be, you know, tapped on it. And I think what's interesting in the rap game is, or at least within the hip hop stuff too, is people have very direct lineages and you can almost hear it within their stuff. And I think, you know, probably the same for strength and conditioning.
Yeah, no, without a doubt. I mean, and they talk about that even in the documentary, which is why I have Ali watch it. I'm like, because it's a lot of our company culture. You need to be self-competitive, but you need to be respect. You always need to respect the craft. Be self-competitive, respect the craft. And I've just never identified, you know, even when I'd go to these NSCA conferences or other conferences, you'd hear people just like trash talking presenters. And I'm like, yo, then get up there if you got it all. Like, get up there and put your stuff on. Like, and I always thought the gaslighting around our industry was really interesting too, where even I was told from a very early onset, like, you don't have a Twitter account, you don't have an Instagram, you don't do anything like that. And I remember hearing like, well, why? And they're like, well, what are you going to say that nobody else has already said? And so I remember I actually said that to one of my athletes when they were like, why don't you have social media? And they're like, dude, so let me get this straight. You think that somebody can only say something once and that you don't have anything of value? And it just got me rethinking of how much I bought into that hook, line, and sinker of like, oh no, this is just an insecure field that, you know, they hide because they don't want to be criticized a lot. And strength and conditioning would be a lot further along if more people would be willing to like celebrate, right? Like, I mean, text, right? I just connected you with a friend of mine. I'm like, power athlete is the best at blank, right? Like, if people would celebrate more people in the field and be like, yo, they're the best, do this. I learned this from them. I learned that from them. This, you'd have better. But when I hear people be like, oh, the field would be better if we'd unionize. I'm like, you guys can't even agree on exercises. You think you're going to get a union?
The other one too, and I think this happens all too often, is a lot of people take credit for things that aren't inherently like things to take credit for. Like if a team wins, or let's say, you know, I'm an NFL strength coach and I have the best players, all of a sudden that coach, everybody wants to know what he's doing. And as I've told many times before with the NFL, the job of the strength coach is just not to hurt the individual, that there's no real development. And you've seen this working with NFL guys. just can't get him hurt. Got to get him training, try to make him a little bit better and allow him to go healthy into training camp and do what they do. And I think that there's this idea of like magic behind it. And it's like, dude, I'm not really interested in what those guys are doing as much so as the people that are actually developing athletes, more so than people that are just shepherding them across their time at the river.
No question. No question.
Brett, what's your take on the Island Boys?
The Island Boys. I feel like I'm out of the loop. Are you talking about like Lonely Island, the SNL thing?
No, they're these two kids from
real
Florida,
genuine artists
that came out with a song that went viral called Island Boys. They have like their head looks like snorks, and they have a bunch of face tattoos.
Face tattoos are always a win. I have
several.
Yeah,
no, I mean serious face tattoos.
Okay. Not like oh wow, yeah, that is a fly soldier. I'm an island boy.
Yeah, they went viral. And then their first live performance.
The reason they went viral, I think, is because Dana White posted them on his social media to where I saw it. And I was like,
as burning them. And
I was like, why is Dana White posting this? And then I realized he has COVID. So, you know, who knows?
Yeah, I mean, listen, the highly credible website, exactnetworth.com, states that their net worth is estimated to be around $150,000. Alex and Frankie Venegas, 20, born in Florida. I've just learned about Florida Man too, which is interesting. Now, what the world really wants to know is their relationship status, which comes up as NA. So good news, ladies, they're eligible. But
are they brothers? Does it say they're brothers?
That I don't know. This is a rabbit hole I'm a little bit scared to go down. Yeah, I don't know what I'll find if I keep going down.
Because they performed their first live show after going viral and blowing up.
And they got booed off?
Oh, yeah. They were booed off the stage.
Nice.
Oh, you know what? No, it says one of them might be dating an Instagram user named Toxic Fairy with two eyes, mind you, both in Toxic and Fairy.
Mm. Callie's alias.
Mm. Yeah.
I think I might have to change my secret hit Twitter handle.
Yeah. Yeah. No catfishing for you, buddy. Those days are done.
Toxic Fairy with Toxic three eyes.
Send those sweet pics. Oh boy. Oh, God. It's good to see you guys again. What hot takes are we going to, what are we going to tackle today? What's on the agenda?
Chris has been writing up a very, very detailed, plan of attack for like the last 3 weeks. I mean, I haven't seen this kid this giddy since ever.
Well, I got some back pocket stuff, but what I want to lead off with is Brett is coming to Austin.
What?
In March. Really? Power Athlete headquarters.
Oh my gosh.
Power Athlete.
Mm-hmm. I mean, are we ready? Do we need to get more crappy trucks and rip them apart?
Oh,
to make
my
it look,
God.
I got to get rid of
some trucks.
This is
going to be awesome.
I think
I got to get rid of some stuff.
I think the thing that you really have to do if you want to be ready is everything like this needs an appropriate movie trailer horn. So, for example, it's like, in a world where Power Athlete and Art of Coaching get together, and Tex's hair is superb. This time, it's for real.
My voice is a little hoarse, but usually that works. One more time with the horn.
Have you been smoking a lot of cigarettes lately? Your voice sounds unusually harsh.
Coaching.
I don't know if you've noticed my branded Conscious Coaching shaker bottle, but inside is small particulates of glass because that's what helps the protein digest and get into the system.
That and your new CBD company, the bearded CBD guy.
Yeah, oh, yeah, that's CBD right.
Yeah, with CBD oil and CBD.
Yeah, Brett, we're starting a new business and you can get in on the ground floor. Could be you, where it's CBD oil / beard oil. And we're pretty sure that we're going to invent some science where the beard absorbs the CBD.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I agree. I think that, you know, there is a buddy of mine in college that I convinced that if he rubbed ketchup on his face, that he would grow a beard. And it had to dry because the lycopene would really get into the pores and helps everything. So this dude, and everybody has this friend, everybody knows this archetype. It's the friend that they're great. They're always going to trust you. They're kind of the party guy. You know, they wake up around noon. You wonder how they even sustain their body weight because they never seem to eat. But then you realize they drink till 3 a.m. And so their body somehow converts that into usable growth fuel. But anyway, you know, so he just goes along with whatever. And he's so anxious to grow a beard. And so about a week goes in and he's like, hey, man, this isn't working. And I go, well, yeah, of course it's not. What kind of ketchup are you using? The one in the fridge? Oh, no. And he goes, yeah, it's Heinz. And I go, Hunt's. It's got to be Hunt's. And he just rears back and just smacks me right in the face. But we ruined about 3 of his pillow sheets in the meantime from just the dried ketchup beard attempt.
So was it this was Pratik Patel?
I'm going to say yes, even though it wasn't. It was definitely Pratik. And if you notice, I think it did work. It's got a little, there was a patch. There's a hint of hair there. So I'm claiming success.
Why not?
I mean, did you do a double blind study? I mean, what type of like control was there?
Yeah, we did a double blind study. Now, this might seem like odd science, but I think the movie Little Giants proved that efficacy behind this. We compared it to people that rubbed evaporated milk on their calves every night before they went to bed. So we did that. We tried Heinz, we tried Hunt's, and then some people, they just laid there and thought about beard growth for about 12 hours. So,
Power Athlete Nation, want to take 1 minute to remind you why Power Athlete is performance for the people. We love the garage gymmer. We love the athlete that is taking their performance into their own hands. We offer 8 different strength and conditioning programs reverse engineered from common goals like getting jacked, becoming more athletic, or introducing the barbell for the first time. To learn which program is best for you, head to powerathletehq.com/training. If you're an enthusiast, a parent, or a professional coach, we also offer education. At academy.powerathletehq.com, learn the method to the madness, the Power Athlete methodology, and a hell of a lot more. Next up, shop.powerathletehq.com. Hoodies, tees, sweats, shorts, you name it, we got it, including posters. You put this up in your garage gym, you're staring at it underneath the bar, I guarantee that you're going to add 10% to your next rep max. And finally, you can check us out on YouTube. We're dropping movement demonstrations going through our setup and execution of the finer movements found on all of our Power Athlete training programs and cutting clips of this podcast that you're listening to right now. So if you want to share in this experience with your lifting buddies, go ahead, seek out Power Athlete on YouTube. And now, back to the premier podcast in strength and conditioning.
Wasn't that the movie with Rick Moranis, where like the running back kid, where he's like, I hear his dad rubs his calves every night with evaporated milk.
Oh, no, yes. The dad admits that.
Yeah, the dad.
That's and then he gets him on that. So team. Awesome.
God, that was a great movie.
Yeah, you're welcome for that deep cut.
I was always a huge Rick Moranis fan. I loved everything he was in.
Did you hear somebody knocked him out?
Oh, yeah.
Somebody,
yeah.
He's just now resurfacing because he wanted to kind of get out of acting for a while. Well,
his wife got sick, I think, with cancer and maybe passed away, and he decided to peel out to like take care of his kids.
That makes even more sense. Yeah. And he was walking down the street. Look this up. Google it now, Tex. I see your computer.
Right, I'm well aware. Yeah.
Yeah. Somebody walked, you know, is those people, the idiotic people that do like the knock at random street knockouts. Somebody ran by him and just I know few things other than you do go directly to hell if you knock out Rick Moranis.
Yeah, dude. He's a good dude. Well, I mean, he plays one of my favorite characters in Ghostbusters.
Oh, yeah.
The nerdy accountant.
Oh man.
Why is that your favorite character?
Oh dude, I think he's great where he's like, you know, like come in, he's giving tax advice, he's throwing Key the party because he wants to basically he needs a tax deduction, so he invites his clients. I think it's just a great part. And he always played a great part. There was like a Little Shop of Horrors. Remember that whole deal with the Venus flytrap? Man, he was always in good movies.
I love this.
It's like 9 million people in New York City, and then this asshole randomly picks out Rick Moranis.
Yeah,
to knock him out.
Man, those knockout things, when I see him, I'm like, holy shit, dude. Like, first of all, the fact that people are filming a felony like that and then posting it, like, I'm just like, what is going on in this fucking world? And more importantly, why isn't the person that get knocked out being like, okay, let's go hunt these people down and kill them?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, if cocaine had a soul, it would be these individuals that decide to do that. I don't understand how somebody thinks that like that. That is okay. And I imagine they do get hunted down. Definitely somebody's getting hunted down for that. And it's just like, that's not even funny. That's like, you can kill someone, you know? And so I think that is a 1-star Yelp review that has come to life. People that do that.
Do you think it's time that actually we have a real life Punisher?
Without a doubt.
Like, I love the Punisher.
I think it's you.
Vigilante justice.
Man, I finally found my calling to go be the Punisher. Drive around in like a 69... flat black charger, 68 charger, and just fucking light people up and be like, oh, you punched that guy. You punched Rick Moranis. Now I get to take you.
Are you the Thomas Jane Punisher or are you the Netflix series Punisher? I don't remember who played him.
I like more the movie Punisher. It was a little more comic booky.
Yeah, the other Thomas one, Travolta with the bad guy.
Yeah, I thought that one was better. I tried to get into the Netflix show and I just couldn't really, I don't know. It just felt very like difficult to like get into the rhythm of watching it.
Yep.
Too,
I agree.
Too high quality versus CW.
No, the CW shows are excellent. I don't know why you're so down on them. I think you got to get into them. I mean, the Arrow, he's a vigilante.
Is the CW like with Titans? My neighbor watches Titans and he keeps trying to get me on that.
DC. Yeah.
Yeah. Like the DC stuff. My kids started watching The Flash. I don't know if you've ever seen it, but like the
running form's awful.
Yeah. Well, he's real fast. So that's all that matters. But my kids started watching it. And then what they did is they integrated.
That's a word?
No, they.
I like it. Let's make
just
it
just roll.
Yeah. They
don't
basically
get hung
brought,
up on
yeah, sorry.
Words.
They basically brought in all these other characters like Supergirl, the Arrow, and they brought in like all this other people of this universe. And so we would watch this show during COVID. And then we were like, who are these other people? And then the girls looked and we have, you know, obviously Netflix and whatever. And they were like, oh, there are these other shows. And now we've watched all these.
This is a bit shit, man. I should have prepared for this superhero running breakdown.
I mean, we
know it's terrible. Captain Marvel. Have you seen that? She runs.
Very stiff. Very stiff. Like when I watch everybody run, everybody just looks stiff and the arm action looks very forced.
Pump the brakes. Tom Cruise is pretty impressive for who he is. Very.
Oh, he's a real life superhero.
He is a real life
superhero. He doesn't play a superhero. He just is.
The fact that Tom Cruise goes in and he's like, I'm not going to do the movie unless I get to do all the stunts. I want you to teach me how to fly a jet.
Can I offer you something that will make your guys' life immediately better? I mean, along the lines of CBD beard oil and that kind of better.
Yeah.
I'm going to ask for permission in this day and age. Yeah. I need permission.
Sure. Okay. I mean, you're not going to whip anything out on us, are you?
No. I'm going to integrate something. Okay. So if you, we need to use that. 10
what did
times.
I say? Did I say intergate or?
Intergate. You're trying to say integrated. I got you, but we're friends. So I'm just giving you a hard time. If anybody wants to do, and I'm going to look this up, I want to fact check it. We have this, I don't like the term mastermind because it just sounds very douchey, but we have this thing called the Coalition. That's just for coaches and people that are trying
to. Is it a mastermind?
Like, I mean, what's the definition?
Less douchey version.
It's a less douchey version.
It's a group. So it's a group of coaches that just kind of feel like, hey, yeah, I love what
so
I do.
So mastermind.
John, I'm going to fight you. So anyway, we have like a retreat that we do at the end of like the 6 months of it, just kind of, you know, because obviously this thing gets super tactical and it can get heavy. And so one night we're like, it's super late and we've had all the deep discussions we're going to have. So somebody whops out a video of every Tom Cruise clip of him running in every movie since like the 1980s. Mm-hmm. And we're watching, and this is like a 20 minute video. And you just get to see how his running evolves over time. And I had gone through I'm a huge hip hop guy, but I had also started listening a little bit more due to Stranger Things, dark synth, you know, that like kind of, it doesn't matter. Dark synth, look it up. It's a whole rabbit hole. I can tell you the origins of how I got into it if you want. But I'm like, this would go really well to dark synth. So then what we did is we decided to mute the sound of the Tom Cruise video and see how it looked up against a dark synth music background. There's no more appropriate Tom Cruise running music than dark synth. It's the kind of music you would hear if you were in like a Knight Rider type vehicle chasing down drug dealers on the interstate in the year 2082. Mm. And it's like weird non-vocal music. I think I heard it in Halloween Horror Nights because we're huge Halloween fans at my in my family at Universal Studios. And then Stranger Things was like a big deal. I'm like, this is a very like unique sound. And then The Weeknd, the artist kind of takes synth based stuff. And that's what makes his music kind of sound so distinct. But anyway, dark synth and Tom Cruise running videos will make for a lethal afternoon. Hmm.
Well, to check this out, Brett's playlist, Power Athlete Radio, Spotify playlist. Brett, we're going to ask you to create one. It's basically going to be all this and probably a Weeknd song.
But he already got the best playlist.
Well, what I'd like to do is I'd like to see like the evolution of where you started and where you finished. So my daughter's 10 and she pulled up Spotify and wanted to know, hey dad, what's some good music for me to listen to? So at that point I like sat down and I was like, hold on. I went and I got a drink and I was like, let's start. Like, where does all this music start? And for me, rock and roll really starts. Like, I understand like the Beatles. I'm just not a huge Beatles fan, but I understand the position. For me, it all started Led Zeppelin. And so then we like rolled through Led Zeppelin, got to like Metallica, and then we got to like the whole British Invasion with like Bruce Dickinson and, you know, Rob Halford, and like went through all that stuff, and then just went through all this kind of metal, and then the death of like glam rock with Nirvana and grunge, and like took her through this like whole journey. And then we got into actually the beginning of rap and hip hop, which I remember is Sugar Hill Gang.
Yep.
You know, yep. and then like when I grew up and it was like gangster rap with NWA, Ice-T and like that stuff, and went through and then kind of just went into these different genres of music, and then kind of where it split. And so, yeah, she sat down, took notes, and we basically made her a playlist that showed this evolution. And I was like, okay, so this is where we're starting. We're starting here, and we got to end here. Now you got to try to figure out all the little branches that go off in between here and figure out what you like. And she was like, okay, I'll go. And then, like, you know, I was like, but you got to listen to enough of the Beatles to appreciate them. But I'm just not a Beatles fan. Like, I never
on got a Beatles note. There is on Disney Plus now an 8-hour Peter Jackson documentary on the Beatles. So 8 hours in Peter Jackson's. What was the word you made up?
Intrigate.
They intrigate.
Yeah, intrigate.
So I haven't watched it yet. I'm down with my dad to watch it.
He's a big Beatles fan, isn't he?
Yeah. But I mean, Stones, Beatles, all that generation.
Like, I feel like you're either Beatles fans or a Stones fan. Like, I feel like it was like.
You can do.
No, weren't you a Beatles fan or a Monkees fan? I don't feel like the Stones compete with the Beatles.
Beatles took a lot of inspiration from the Monkees. That's a joke. But any.
Dude, did you guys remember like the Monkees TV show?
No, hold on.
This is a more important point. Am I too old for you guys for the fact that I remember as a little kid seeing the Monkees come on? Hey, where are the Monkees? Did you know they had a TV show?
I did not know they had that.
So the Monkees weren't actually a real band. They started there was a TV show, and then they became a band off the TV, and then that's how they became, actually they were put together for a TV show.
Well, anyway, the Monkees. The Beatles in it, Jackson like has 50 takes of certain songs. And then they show the creative process, and then they have just a film crew filming the band talking, and then you see Paul McCartney like working on it, and then it becomes like Let It Be. So he's working on his own, interjecting into the conversation and back into the music, and then, hey guys, we're going to try this, and then it plays, they get into the rep. So it's like multiple different creation processes, and then you see the evolution of the Beatles as like transitioning from Lennon's band to McCartney's band, yep, and then breakup. So like 8 hours right in your line, Brett, with mastery, understanding, and then music. So I haven't watched it. I've just listened to reviews about it, but I'm going to wait for holidays with my dad to deep dive. But I think you'd
really, I like that. Yeah. My, with my parents, I made them watch the Defiant Ones. And I think we talked about it maybe once on when I was on here, but the Defiant Ones was like Dr. Dre and Jimmy Iovine. Yep. And it starts, you know, from both of their kind of origin stories, and then also how then Dr. Dre found Eminem and all this, and then the found, you know, how Interscope came together in Aftermath, and eventually how they went on to create Beats by Dre, right? But it covers, it's a cool evolution, and it relates to strength and conditioning as well, because I've always looked at music as like a perfect ersatz to S&C in that, or what it should aspire to be. Jimmy Iovine started as kind of just like an intern and then became a producer and then ended up creating a label, and then he was this. Dr. Dre started as a DJ, then was a rapper, then was a producer, then a label owner, then this. I think another core issue in strength and conditioning, and I talk about this in one of our courses, is like there's still no people don't evolve in it. For a field that's obsessed with adaptations, it doesn't really adapt. It's like there's so many people that they think, oh, no, I can just go to college, I can go to pro, or I can die on the floor in the private sector, right? To the point where if you even become a student in business or you create a brand, you're looked at as a sellout. But Jay-Z can go from a street corner to rapping to being a billionaire, and you know that's lauded. And so I think S&C very much has an evolution problem where it doesn't really, it only identifies with like this one thing. Obviously, you guys are very different, right? And there's other people out there that are different, but I'm talking about collectively as a field, you don't know many happily married, financially secure, healthy strength coaches who actually are able to retire. And that also is not throwing stones at anybody that's gone through a divorce or anything like that, right? I'm well aware that, you know, I'm married right now, and in 10 years of that, we could, like, things happen. My point is the field generally has no kind of point where like my dentist on the street was a dental hygienist, a dentist now owns his own practice. Strength and conditioning just doesn't have healthy attitudes towards evolution because it's always just idolized this kind of, no, you're a coach and you're on the floor and that's all you'll do. And it's about everybody else but you. But inside a lot of coaches, and I will argue this till I'm dead in the grave, because this is a lot of what we supported, Art of Coaching. A lot of coaches are really broken because they get into the field in their 20s and then all their focus is on everybody else, right? As it should be. That's our job, to guide, to lead, to orchestrate. But they don't also fill their own cup because they've been told that that's selfish and that's bad. And then at about 35, you're like, why am I burnt out? And why am I like this? And, you know, why don't I have this? And we just get a lot
of questions. Where does that narrative come from? I mean, is that from the old crusty, the old guard? It depends. Kind of put that in?
It depends how deep you want to get into this. Like I went down a very, very dark rabbit hole with this because I experienced it in my own life, just the way I came up in the field. And so our online course Valued is essentially about that. It's because we had so many coaches, John, that would reach out, that'd be like, hey, I'm overwhelmed. I'm burnt out. I know I love what I do, but nobody sees my value. I'm tired of writing programs and being at work all the time when a coach can basically come and say, we're skipping that, we're skipping this. I've moved my family 15 times for $40,000 a year. And when I did make money, I was fired after 2 years, even though I did what I was supposed to do in the weight room. What do we do? And so we went deep into the origins of that. And I struggle making it concise. It's a combination of which part you want to tackle. The unhealthy attitude towards money is a little bit of like cognitive dissonance, that old, you know, Aesop's fable, Fox and the Grapes. Coaches don't get paid much, right? And so they run around. I always wanted to know, why do they say, oh, the first book I was ever given, other than like Super Training and Science and Practice, was First In, Last Out, right? And you hear coaches say, oh, I'm not in it for the money. I'm the first one in. I'm the last one out. It's not about me. What we found is this is a form of, and Irving Goffman gets the credit for this, impression management. It was coaches trying to create a differentiating factor through what's called an exemplification impression management tactic, meaning they want to make themselves look better by appealing to moral virtue. Mm. And that actually has, and there's research to support this, that actually has its foundations in the education world. Substitute teachers who are trying to get jobs, but they, you know, school districts maybe weren't hiring. They would always just be like, hey, if there's an opportunity, I'll do it for less and all this stuff. And Irving Goffman wrote about it in the 50s. So, you know, other examples of this will be, so exemplification will be appealing to moral virtue. Of course, we all know intimidation. Then there's supplication. Another thing you see in the field a lot, supplication is when, imagine people say, take self-deprecation too far. So you ever know somebody that's really smart, but they always are like, oh, I'm the dumbest guy in the room. Oh, I don't know much. Or, oh, I just have a simple West Virginia education, right? They just kind of downplay themselves all the time. And to a point, it's humility. To beyond a point, you're kind of like, all right, dude. So there's five different major impression management tactics that people will utilize to create differentiation for themselves. So you have a field that by and large isn't exposed to economics, to business practices. There's not a lot of great examples of coaches that came in and adhered to sound practices, went on and kind of, you know, evolved into different lifestyles. And if there was, it wasn't something celebrated. You could look at the Mark Verstegens or the Mike Boyles or other coaches that have done that and created a lifestyle, but somebody's always got something to say about it. And so the simple answer is, when you take people who, by and large, many of us were, with the exception of you, John, average to slightly above average athletes who found security and confidence in the weight room, right? And we're highly competitive either with ourselves or others. And you channel that into a profession, right? Like when you make a hobby into what you do, and that hobby was a way for you to get confidence and an edge, people are kind of channeling that competitive edge the wrong way. And they don't understand differentiation. So you go into it's marketing 101. You go into a Kroger or anything like that. There's bottled water, carbonated water, oxygenated water, alkaline water, all this, but it's all water. Right? It's all water. Strength coaches have become all water. Oh, I'm the Olympic guy. Oh, I'm this guy. I'm the speed guy. I'm the agility guy. Well, really what a lot of them are is like the average public doesn't really understand what all this means to the extent that we do. And because of that, and it's not understood, people just want to argue over it. And then they just want to shout, we're the best, we're this. So yeah, I mean, there's many things that lead to it, but it's deeply rooted in failed attempts to differentiate, not a lot of self-awareness, hyper-competitiveness, anxiety, and then also, frankly, no true way to evaluate the field. And this is the last thing I'll say on it. is there a place that you guys love in Austin that is like, it's one of your favorite restaurants? Is there a place that you just love?
Terry Black's Barbecue.
Yeah, I like Terry Black's. Okay. Valentino's.
Is it reasonable to think that there's some people that think those places suck? It's not their favorite. Right.
Yeah. I mean, look at Yelp reviews.
Sure. Just like, you know, you can have a farm to table place out here that people love and then other people hate it. And somebody might like a crap restaurant because it's where they met their wife or anything like that. Or research we talk about in Valued, some of the top rated law firms in the country were evaluated. One company that pays this firm $500 million in annual retainer is like, they don't win every case, but they answer the phone. So value is subjective. Value is subjective. Sure. So when I came up, it was all these arguments in these forums and on Facebook. We need a way to be evaluated. You know, we need a way. Well, you couldn't even agree on who's going to evaluate you, let alone what you're going to be evaluated on, what the best coaches are the only ones that can teach flawless weightlifting technique. And this leads to why we created Art of Coaching. We started deep diving into coach development and what expert coaching is really perceived as. And there's this really great article written by, let me pull this up. There's this really, really, really great article written by Andy Abraham, Bob Muir, Dave Collins, and there's many others like this by Paul Potrack. And it just talks about what underpins the development of an expert coach. And Robin Jones and folks talk about, well, listen, coaching by itself is a social practice. So to try to evaluate an expert coach based on technical expertise is not good enough because it's a social practice between social beings in a social environment. And so we know that communication's at the core of it. So you already have this ambiguous field of like, how do you evaluate it? Because you can teach, you can choose all the right exercises, teach them extraordinarily well, team might still not win, right? So again, value is objective. There's no clean way to evaluate. But then you have what I found in the research is nobody was evaluating the social side of that. And I'm not talking about verbal and nonverbal. I'm talking about really what are the underpinnings of true interpersonal skills? What are the meta categories? And we found that there was nothing exclusively that focused on that. So to try to reduce the subjectivity of value and what is a great coaching, which is underpinned by great communication, that's the gap we wanted to hit. So that's a huge part of it too, is when you don't have an objective way to evaluate yourself, people are going to start arguing, pointing fingers and using their insecurity to just get louder voices to all to try to appear like they're the expert in the room because no key metric speaks for them. Does that make sense?
Yeah. It reminds me of a statement that I coined years ago when playing for the Eagles. In the absence of true leadership, false prophets appear.
I love that. Yep.
And it's true. I mean, like, you know, like there's no meaningful way for people to evaluate and know whether or not they're doing a good job. It just looks like false prophets. And we used to see that all the time. Like all of a sudden, you know, people that like, you know, the leaders decide not to lead. And then all of a sudden you have a whole bunch of people just spouting off, making fucking preposterous claims. And I always remember being like, fucking false prophets, dude. And that was an interesting point for me as a young guy when I realized that a lot of times too, people equate age and experience with leadership. And I realized that leadership a lot of times is just the motherfucker that wants to grab the wheel. And the person that's enough of an individual and enough of a like a dynamic personality does their job in such a way that people want to follow that individual.
In line with that, in sports, the position. You are the quarterback. You are the leader.
Yeah, but like I played with quarterbacks that weren't great leaders.
Yes.
And, you know, and people always look to those individuals. But at the end of the day, you know, and there's a whole bunch of different leadership styles. I mean, there's a guy who's just kind of like keeps your head down and is the fucking mule that just keeps pushing and pushing, pushing. You know, the consistent guy. There's a rah-rah guy. And I just, absence of true leadership, man, false prophets appear. And you can't win in the NFL or really just in any sport unless you have some form of leadership. And, you know, that's why, you know, you look at the teams that are successful, especially late in the season, when you start looking in the NFL for like in that Q4, the teams that have really good leadership and more importantly, like they know who they are the ones that end up getting a chance to go to the Super Bowl.
Mm. Yeah. Well, I mean, and I think it's something that definitely separates you guys. And it was nice having Tex at one of our events. What was it? 2 years ago, Tex, but
June or July, 2020.
What I mean is like you guys enjoy getting into the weeds and you're socially astute and you're technically skilled, right? That to me is the bedrock of expert coaching. And so like to give you an example of one of the articles, to get nerdy for a second, there's this great one, which really when we were looking at, hey, we want to validate improv is such a unique tool that's being used in the medical field and so many other fields. And it's got interesting roots in social work where, you know, people think improv as like comedy, but really, you know, improv is just decision-making and problem solving that's ad hoc, right? It's using available resources to solve problems. And so there were these two women, Neva Boyd and Viola Spolin. And really what during like the New Deal and when the Great Depression was going on, improv was used to teach immigrant children how to assimilate into American culture. Cause it was kind of this flattening hierarchical way of saying, hey, if you don't speak that great of English or you're kind of like awkward because you're an immigrant, that's okay. We're going to use adapted theater games. So everybody kind of has to find their way out of this hole. And I know that in like 2014, and then I'll get to the article, you know, I was kind of getting burnout in the sense that like, I love coaching, right? I wasn't getting burnout on that, but it felt like things were getting a little bit too easy from the standpoint of like, if we needed to do an acceleration session, we always had sleds and we had, you know, had everything you needed from a plyometric standpoint, med balls, we had all this stuff. So an intern had come up to me and was like, what do you want for the acceleration session this morning with the NFL guys? And I just wanted more of a challenge for myself. This was all about self-competition. This wasn't about dick measuring. This wasn't anything else. Like I'm very self-competitive. And I said, you know what, man, like pick one tool. And in truth, if I can't show you how to run an acceleration session with one tool, and more importantly, something that I could actually validate or explain to a judge if I had to, then I'm not really good at my job. And so he was like, all right. And he had picked a med ball. So we did that. And I started doing this more and more. I started just finding ways to bring similar constraints that I would bring into agility sessions or things like that with athletes into my coaching. So like social constraints. Another example, and I talked about it at the apprenticeship, is an adapted theater game called Last Letter First. So the idea is I'd say something. And if I said good morning, the last letter there is G. Right. Or sorry, if somebody said good morning to me, I would have to respond in a relevant way with a word or a phrase that started in G. So I always use the example of an athlete where I said, hey, man, how do you feel today? And this guy was like, sore. Well, that ends in an E. So I'd say everywhere. And he's like, my shoulder. That starts, ends in an R. Really? Have you tried this? And that was an example of me just, hey, listen more closely. Try to challenge yourself. So as we got into the research, we found this article that was talking about how like sociology has been in scant service when you analyze what makes an expert coach, and that needs to change. And there was a gentleman named Pierre Bourdieu, and without going into that background, right? Like he kind of just said, hey, you know, the coaching process and coaching practice itself is a form of regulated improvisation. And this was from a 1977 article he had. And what he meant by that is the practice is neither objectively determined, but it's also not the unbridled product of free will. Like, of course, we have this idea of where we're going, but you have to adapt it. But you didn't have any things that taught this to coaches. You just didn't. It's not at workshops. It's not at this. And it turns out there's been this call to arms in the sport coaching realm for decades now. And nobody's really created, of course, people have done certain things, but nobody's created something that's been kind of universally adopted. And so we said, I mean, let's do this. And it became like the manifestation of our doctorate. But I mean, that is the one thing that's still subjective, right, John? Like communication can be subjective, but we at least need to have, there are objective ways to know what are the ramifications of, you know, if somebody uses this tone of voice, or if somebody uses this kind of influence tactic, or if somebody frames something in this way and anchors it or uses these analogies versus this kind of explanation. It's so much deeper than cueing. And there's so many odd things that influence us in life, color, design, music, because perception is really what colors our world. And so, yeah, anyway, like, I just think that that's something that's interesting. And that goes back to hip hop, right? That is expert use of language if it's an actual true hip hop artist. And I just think it's a rabbit hole we can't really help but continue to go down, because what's the alternative? We just continue to argue about exercises and teach coaches exercises. It's yes. And yes, they have to do that. But anything that separates you at the highest level, if you, me and Tex are competing for a job and we're all good at teaching the clean and the deadlift and all these things, I mean, a core separator is going to be our interpersonal skills and our conceptual problem solving. So.
Sure. Well, that, and also how well you identify with the individual, and more importantly, how quick you make bridges. As I was listening to you speak, I started doing like the Rolodex of all the coaches I've worked with. And the one thing that I always found the biggest put off was when there was a lot of like angst, or more like just anger at the position and how they were doing, that just seeped through into the coaching. And it just felt very bitter. And I dealt with a lot of coaches that were just either unhappy, felt they were underappreciated and didn't have the ability to, like, you know, table that aspect. And it just seeped out into the coaching and just felt very, like, just fucking toxic. And
have you ever felt under, like, even you guys being in a service industry and being coach, and, you know, I hope you can be, you feel like you can be candid here, because there's so many people that look up to you guys, but this is a genuine question. I mean, have you guys even not as a player, John, but as a coach or even as a service provider now, like, what makes you, if anything, feel underappreciated as a coach? Like, what kind of behaviors make you feel underappreciated? If you ever do.
For me, I mean, not really. I know, well, I appreciate the minutiae of things. Like, I want to hear the long story. Like, if there's like, you know, I hate when we start talking, people are like, oh, you know, I'll give you the abbreviated version. I'm like, no. I like the depth. I like to know, like, all the layers. I want to hear the beginning and the after. I want to hear, like, the, you know, the hero's journey, love lost, love won. I mean, I want to know just about everything. And so because I'm like that, it gets a little frustrating sometimes where people are just so superficial on everything. You know, like, let's say it's on our programs or some of the stuff. I had a guy hit me up with, well, why do we do it this way? And it was just kind of like a rude, like, very curt, but then I have to remember it's the internet. So then I write a long dissertation on exactly what's going through my mind, and, like, it was like three paragraphs. And the guy's like, oh, I knew it was something like that. Okay, great program. Thanks. And, you know, it was like, you know, we got into, like, post-activation potentiation and why this and movement quality and, you know, having tens of thousands of data points and literally looked at thousands of videos that the movement quality increases when we do this. And so this is why this is strung together, and just kind of, like, went through all this arrangement and why we do it this way based on this, you know, economy of time, economy of movement, economy of volume. And I just got into all these things. And I think the dude was probably like, I was just asking a simple question to this dude. And it's because if you're going to ask me a question, I'm going to give you as deep as I can go, whether or not you want it or not. Like, don't raise your hand unless you want the answer. So I think in that piece, I also have to remember sometimes that not everybody geeks out on this stuff the way we do, or that somebody has as much experience. So a lot of times, like, if somebody's asking a question, it's not necessarily in a combative way. Whereas when we started teaching the original seminar, when we were working with CrossFit and I went out and I started teaching it, people would ask questions in literally combative ways. Like, hey, so what, you know, why this? Because they wanted to battle us. So I got kind of in used to this thing where, you know, as I would get up and present, let's say I had a 45-minute, an hour talk, if somebody raised their hand, I would stop and I would answer their question. Before, when I was young in it, I'd be like, hey, save all your questions to the end, I'll answer it. And then I got to the point where somebody raised their hand, I would stop and fucking curb stomp them and then get right back into what I was doing. And I think that little bit of, like, dealing with those people, but then after we had done it for so long, we stopped getting those people, and the people that were showing up were already bought in and were there for the experience.
You made a really good point on that one. If I can interject, I'm going to intergate because I've been guilty sometimes of when I've come on this show, like, when I'm so passionate about the movement that we are trying to create of, I still geek out over the training stuff. It seemed crazy to me that there were some coaches that took the communication and the social side for granted, just because communication can start wars in marriages. You know, it can do all these awful things. And most people that think they're already good at it are the ones that need it the most. And there used to be times, and probably still are, where I'm so passionate about that, I would catch myself rambling as if trying to, like, go at the people that still don't believe it. And it was just, it was kind of dumb. It was well-intentioned, but dumb, because, you know, you're not going to convince those people, right? Even the people that are even semi-interested or not interested in this stuff at all, they're not even going to listen to this episode once they see my name on it. And so I had to learn how to just talk more to the people that are already bought into it, the people that are committed, the people that are doing it. And it really increased the quality of my life, because then you didn't always have this battle rap mentality where in my brain, I'm always hearing the devil's advocate view. Like, I remember when my book came out and somebody posted on Twitter, you know, oh, great, a book on how to communicate, as if I don't do that every day in my life. And I'm like, bro, like, everybody communicate. Right. Like, who thinks, like, if you do something every day, isn't the idea of mastery that you continue to refine it? We're all apprentices in a craft where you never master. And if anybody thinks they're an expert in communication, the question that then trips them up is like, okay, then how are you evaluating that? You know, and we ask that as part of the doctorate, like the semi-structured interviews. I'd say, how would you rank yourself as a communicator? 1 to 10, 10 being extremely strong, 1 being, you know, not very strong. And somebody would say, you know, oh, 7, 8. And I'd be like, great. What tool did you use to either objectively or subjectively evaluate that?
Well, and you should just ask them their marriage status. If I want to know if somebody's good. No, it's true. If I want to know somebody's level of communication, I'll ask them their marriage status. Because
but what if they just haven't found the one yet?
Maybe they're lazy. Who knows? Maybe the right girl hasn't come along. But I know a lot of times, as I would listen to people and they would, you know, want to talk about communication in this. I mean, as you know, you're married. There's a lot of communication and there's, you know, sometimes, hey, I'm sorry. Like if something's going on, I usually just apologize just to get out of the way. I'm like, I don't know what I did, but I'm sorry if I did it. So now can we talk about it? I mean, I think you learn how to navigate the circles. And a lot of times, if I want to know what kind of communicator, or more importantly, if somebody understands how to, you know, how to work within a structure, usually marriage status is usually a pretty good one. Does your wife hate you? Can I call your wife and ask if she likes you or not? Because if I call her and she tells me you hate you, there's a good chance that you're full of shit and you don't know how to communicate.
Yeah. Unless somebody's married to a poor communicator themselves, right? Like, because then it's, that person's wife or husband might not like them. And one's just better at self-disclosure and communicating, and the other one's more. I mean, I have a friend like that. He's an excellent communicator. His wife's a miserable communicator, and it makes stuff so much harder on him. And by default, she holds, I would say, and she's, you know, like resentment. And it's like, yo, like you're the one that like doesn't work on that. But either neither here nor there. Like the answer we got by one of them, and he laughed at this later, right? So he knew this was absurd, and he was like, oh my God, it kind of woke him up to it. I go, so what ways have you evaluated yourself? And he's like, really nothing. He goes, in the past, I've gauged if I'm a good communicator, did people do what I told them to do? And then we had a really interesting discussion about the difference between compliance and commitment. Because just because somebody did what you told them to do is not a byproduct of great communication. Right? There's many reasons people do partake in a particular behavior, and they're not always doing it of their own free will and accord. Compliance is, if you ask me to do something, and let's say I feel good about you, John, and I do, right? If you ask me to do something like I'm a friend, I consider you a friend, I'd do it. But let's say you ask me to do something kind of like shady and whatever, I do it, I might do it. That's more compliance. It's like, all right, I like John, this task I'm a little iffy on. Or it could be the other way. It's just an asymmetry between what you call the relation and task quotient. How you feel about the person and the... Hold on, just let me finish for a sec. Okay. Commitment is... if you ask me to do something and I'm all the way bought in on you and what you're asking me to do and the bigger purpose of it. So, you know, all I'm saying here is saying that you're an excellent communicator solely because somebody does what you ask them to do is not a good metric, because that goes into power dynamics. What kind of power do you hold over them? You know, what's their, there's many other reasons somebody decides to follow through with a behavior, and that by itself can't be, oh yeah, no, you're definitely a communicator if everybody does what you tell them to do all the time. That's just not a metric.
No, I can't agree more.
Creepy to think. I mean, think about Weinstein-esque kind of stuff.
Yeah. I mean, the stories that came out about like him, for example, and how he lorded over these women, and like these women kept these secrets because of their career. Like I was reading about like Selma Hayek, that he attacked her and she basically
got her too.
Yeah. And she kept her mouth shut, and didn't tell anybody. And then it was only when it came out. And I guess like I was an interview with, so I've been doing, hyperbarics. So, I go at 7 a.m. and I do like, you know, it's basically 15 minutes up or down, 15 minutes up. So it's 90 minutes in this tube. And so like, I'll sit there and I'll watch some, I don't know, whatever pops up on Facebook, videos. But there was something like an interview about that Harvey Weinstein, because I was reading something on Jeff Epstein's girlfriend trial, and then the Weinstein.
Oh yeah, she goes to trial this month.
Well, yeah, she's in trial right now, and so they won't let the cameras in, so they're doing sketches, which is really wild, and they're redacting everything, which I think unlike what we saw with the Kyle Rittenhouse thing, where they had every camera in the room and this and that, like they are doing. There's like 3 sketch artists that are allowing there. And everything is redacted, because I think what they're so scared of is that they're going to out somebody. Like Prince Andrew was, you know, a pedophile or something. I mean, just something where you're like, holy shit, like now we have huge problems. So I think they're really controlling the information. But it got into this Weinstein deal, and it was talking about like the women that he attacked, and of course. But yeah, like the Selma Hayek thing, I was like, didn't know he was. And then they went through all the women and how he used it and manipulated it and the way it went. And I'm like, what a fucking piece of shit is a human.
Oh man, well, how about the Theranos stuff too? That's another thing where I don't think they're allowing cameras in, and it's all sketches and Elizabeth Holmes and all. You guys, have you read about this at all?
No, what is this?
So Theranos, essentially, in a nutshell, this woman had started a company that...
with the blood.
Yeah, drop of blood.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Dude, yeah.
And so this was a documentary. I think I watched it a year ago on a plane. And you just got into it. And it was just, you know, she had gone to Stanford. Theranos was like a privately held company, right? And they were promising.
Did she raise like $500 million in VC?
Oh, money? Yeah. And not only that, right? She had like Henry Kissinger and who's who. I mean, the people on the board didn't make sense, but it was when you start studying her, this was an incredibly persuasive woman who probably knew that if she got a lot of well-known household names on a board, that people were going to not have as many questions, despite the fact many of them came out. I mean, it might have been one of the 5-star generals that was on there. Maybe it was Mattis or something like that. That was like, I had to buy a book on like how to be a board member.
I think it was Petraeus. Wasn't it Petraeus?
Yeah. I don't know. I'd have to look it up. Right. Yeah. But like, I know this, the idea was for anybody listening that doesn't know, they devised blood tests that required only a small amount of blood and could be performed. Like right. Rapidly using these automated devices. But these claims were proven to be false. They raised more than $700 million from venture capital. Obviously, I've gone down in this rabbit hole a lot. And I mean, they were just lab assistants being like blood was getting splattered everywhere. The machines weren't working. She did the whole black turtleneck Steve Jobs thing. And she had another guy that was an early investor. I can't remember, in a massive company. I think his name was Sonny Balwani. And they were dating, but now all of a sudden, like just seeing how people manipulate this. And of course, all this is alleged, right? It's alleged fraud. But like they were dating, they released all these texts, and now she's saying, no, he assaulted me and he's the one that crafted me into this. And then, but they're just doing sketches. They're not showing you much because there's a lot of high profile people involved in this.
When we were still out in California, this happened to be about 4 years ago, 5 years ago, Kyle Turley hit me up. You know, he had a CBD company. I'm a small investor in, and we had to go to this meeting with these big VC dudes that was in Palm Springs. So we went to this big high rise in Palm Springs, met with these guys that were, you know, I mean, fucking big money dudes, and they were interested in, you know, putting money. And the guy who was the main money behind it had invested millions of dollars in it and was bragging to me about how about this company, and was like, you know, these are the type of deals I'm involved in, and threw that one out. And I was like, oh, you know, because I had heard about it. And I was like, oh, man. And he had put a huge chunk of money.
Theranos, is that what you're talking about? Yeah. He threw that one out?
Cool. Yeah. And he had put a huge chunk of money into it and, you know, was bragging about it. And this would have to be at least five plus six years ago. And so I wrote the name down and went back and researched it. I'm like, first of all, I think I hit up Dr. Tom and was like, what do you think on this? And he's like, the technology's not there. And he goes, and they're going to put those machines in CVS, and they're going to put them everywhere. I mean, the idea is that you could walk into any pharmacy, and with one drop of blood on your finger, like you're doing a glucose test, like a diabetic would do.
A John Wick thumbprint on the mark.
Yeah, and you could have like this endless amount of blood history. And it was cheap, and this. And I remember Dr. Tom being like, I'm just telling you, I'm so far into this blood testing thing, and I know that technology does not exist. And I was like, well, I just talked to some dude who's got millions of dollars in it. And he's like, well, that's no good. But
well, just goes to show, I mean, anybody's capable, like, right. Even us, we're all capable of being duped. And and that goes into the subjectivity of human perception as well. And especially if you start looking around the false consensus bias and you're like, well, Henry Kissinger's in here and Mattis or Petraeus or whoever else is in here and 5 Stanford people are in here. Looks good. And, you know, it's just a fallacy of experts. You know, every single one of us can be made in. And I think that's why it's important, too. And you guys do an excellent job of this on your podcast. You always have, of just being like, listen, we reserve the right to be wrong, right? Things that we're all going to say that we're like, I mean, but that's again, that's the man in the arena. That's the cost you pay to just like, I'd rather be somebody that states views and, you know, you're fallible just like anybody else, than just sitting on the sideline and not standing for anything, not saying anything. And we could even get into a political discussion about that, of why it's so weird, like why it's so weird that like you're never just going to have a quote unquote normal person run for president, because it's like, who amongst us is ever right all the time, doesn't have some skeletons in our closet, or somebody's got a text that they sent to a friend in context of something else. Text definitely has sent a lot of nudes. That Dropbox is not even 2-factor authentication. So Texas nudes are going to come out any day now. But you know what, Tex, if you had nudes that came out, I'd still vote for you over some guy that's got like.
Think about the narcissistic, the narcissistic nature and like the, you know, narcissistic personality qualities that would require you to want to do that job. I mean, like just looking at like the aging of presidents, the only guy that actually kind of looked like he got younger was Trump. I think just goes to show you what a sociopath he is in so many different ways that like he somehow thrived. Like his lifeblood was that level of like confusion, battle, fight. I mean, the guy probably popped out of bed every morning to fight a war with everybody on media and this. I mean, 2 a.m. Twitter. Like I just think
also like text.
Yeah. But I think there's certain people that flourish in like muddy water. Greg Glassman, for example, was just like that. Like the muddier the water, the bigger the conflict, the bigger the fight, the more he fucking like the fact that he got ousted out of CrossFit and has been marginalized is probably the slowest death or quickest death that we could ever hope for him.
What's he doing now?
Nobody fucking knows. I think he's writing a tell-all book is what I heard on CrossFit. But you know what? Like, okay, so what? But it's pretty wild to see a guy like Trump because that's where I think he strived. I mean, it aged Obama in dog years. I mean, Obama coming in versus leaving. I mean, just the amount of time and like just stress associated with that job. I mean, it takes a very, very fit, intellectually intelligent and fucking high motored individual to even be able to do that job. I mean, I think they need an age cap on it. Like there should be no 80-year-old man fucking wheeling around doing that job.
Well, I mean, even think about just being in any level of imagine you're the guy behind the guy and guy being an inclusive term behind the guy that's writing the bills, writing this. Imagine all the people that have stayed up till 3 a.m. on pots of coffee, writing 300-page bills that they swore was going to make some change. And the next day they go to drop it off on the senator's office or whatever. And somebody's like, yeah, man, I got the call from so-and-so last night. This is all done now. And you're like, just remember that time where you went through college and you got this paper done on time. Or right now I'm trying to. It was the dumbest decision I've ever made, or one of them, to try to do my doctorate. I can't imagine the euphoria I'll feel when I'm just like, F this. And I'm only doing it not so people can call me like, oh, Dr. Brett, we're doing it because we're validating the methods that we're using at our workshops. And it just makes sense based on prior work and what was there. But anyway, like the euphoria of that, imagine these people who have done this massive thing that they think is going to change the country, change the world, change lives. And they're like, meh, just imagine how many reams of paper. I mean, that is a job. Politics is by and large to a degree. And I think the discerning listener knows what I mean, that you almost get into knowing you're not going to create a change. And I'm of course not saying that's everybody, but for every person that makes it through all this stuff, creates the change they wanted, there are millions of other people that wrote bills, wrote this, ghost wrote that, tried to do this, lobbied for this, filibustered that, and just nothing changed except they got older, to your point. Right. Their telomeres got shortened and they did.
Yeah. No. Well, I mean, and just the stress. I mean, like the stress associated with it and the interesting optics of like good guy and bad guy. But yet behind closed doors, everybody's buddies. So like there's this public perception of this person and this. But like, you know, you go to dinner in D.C. and you see all these people sitting at the same table. So, I mean, there's a lot of interesting like perception versus reality of what's going on, like the public, what they say, the way they act in terms of the cameras, but what really goes on behind closed doors. So I think the issue is that, you know, because we're so far removed from it, I mean, you know, if you're only optic into politics is what you see on social media, you are not only are you fucking removed, you're like you couldn't be farther on Mars. And then you see how polarized people are. Like, you know, I gauge old, what is it? Believe none of what you hear and half of what you see. I mean, that's the way I view all of this stuff. And I'm amazed that people get so polarized on just these minute things that are being fed to them within these different social media streams that you don't even know how accurate they are. I spoke at a conference on national security for the War College up in Pennsylvania. And in one of the talks, they were talking about there was like a right-wing Christian political movement, and of like they were like of all the, I think it was 90% of the pages that run this kind of ideology on Facebook are operated and run by Russian bot farms. So there's right wing conservatives, you know, on Facebook. 90% of the groups associated with that are literally run, managed, and the information is generated and pushed out by Russian bots.
I want to hear Tex's thoughts. Weigh in. Where you at, Tex?
I'm currently looking at the origin of believe nothing what you hear and half of what you see.
That should be Mark Twain, right? Was it close?
They are American. It was either Benjamin Franklin or Edgar Allan Poe.
I thought that was I'll take either one of those.
Debate this. could you make an argument that that is in some way related to the phrase buy the rumor, sell the news?
Is that Ben Franklin?
I don't know who started that. I think that was Wall Street Bets on the Reddit thing. I'm just kidding. I don't know. Let's see. But it's all related to like when people, even like crypto and everything that, you know, right now is like people will say like rumors always have an effect on a security or an asset's price, and news can have the opposite effect. So if you hear, oh, so-and-so is going to release this, right? The stock price or the value
Blue
of it might go up.
Blue Horseshoe loves Anacott Steel.
What?
Blue Horseshoe loves Anacott Steel.
What is that?
Wall Street.
Wall Street. You don't remember when he calls up and he calls the guy who's like in charge of like the Wall Street paper, and he just calls up and he's like, hello. He's like, Blue Horseshoe loves Anacott Steel. And then that's what blows him up in Wall Street.
Oh, yeah. Well, dude. Yeah, prime example.
Michael Douglas is so awesome.
But, oh, it's a great movie.
Yeah. Yep. No, I think that's huge. I think, you know, yeah. There are so many rabbit holes we could go down in that one. I want to hear what's on Tex's mind. Tex, you've been kind of uniquely quiet. What's going, if I actually could see inside your head right now, what does that look like, Tex? Like what thoughts go through your head? Like in the last,
it's like a midget riding a tricycle.
Wait, John speaking. You ever seen the Simpsons clip where they like show inside Homer's faint and it's like some like black and white cow dancing or something or playing a violin?
It's like a, it's like a monkey riding a tricycle. And, the only problem is there's like a black and white TV that keeps cutting out of my voice being like, Tex,
time to shine in. Look this up.
I always think, do you guys
awkward remember transition?
Do you remember Black Sheep?
Oh, of course.
Right.
You think mean of, the movie?
Yeah, the movie where, okay. You know, the guy, Chris Farley calls it. He goes, you know, hey, every guy's got a dream. Am I right? Between you, me, and the wall here, I had a doozy of one myself last night. Get this, a corn-fed harvest mouse, a hooker, a nun, a Flemish peasant woman, whips, chains, whistles, yo-yos, a circus midget, my grandmother on a tricycle giving me the finger, and a duck. And then he goes, oh, my Lord, I'm sorry, honey. Could you get your daddy on the phone? That's what goes through.
Dude, as soon as you said Black Sheep, did you know that there was a TV show back when we were kids? It was called the Black Sheep Squadron. Did you ever see that?
No.
That's what I thought you were talking about. And I'm like, no, but I like Black Sheep better.
Oh, yeah. I'll tell you, my favorite of all time movie or show trope is like when we cut into the scene and we only see the punchline and people laughing. Like in Dumb and Dumber, like he's envisioning his future with Mary Swanson. And he's like in this turtleneck sweater. And he's like, well, do you love me? No, but that's a big chainsaw. Ah, and they all burst into laughing. It's like, what was that lead up? I got no idea. Yeah. But I just love that in any sort of movie. If you have that, like in that Black Sheep, like I'm fucking dead.
I saw it was Howard Stern interviewing David Spade. And he basically is like, if Farley hadn't died, do you think he would have had a better career? He's like, you guys could have done this comedy skit forever. You could have been like Bruce Willis doing terrible movies. You guys could have literally done this skit for the next 50 years. And he's like, yeah, I think about that all the time when I get pitched these awful movies. He goes, I wonder if Farley was alive, if I would still be getting, if I'd actually get good stuff. And it was like, then they both just kind of paused and they were like, and then they went on. And I was like, oh, God damn it. That was fucking rough.
Man. Oh, yeah, David Spade's still on fire. Dude, he's still
I love it. He's my favorite follow on Instagram.
Yeah.
Here's a hot take. If Tupac was alive, would people like Drake be rapping?
You know, I mean, just for me personally, in the age in which I grew up, it was like there was Tupac and there was Biggie. And like the lineage for that was like the gangster rap and then the East Coast, West Coast stuff. And like then all of a sudden Dr. Dre. I mean, that this is terrible, but I still probably listen to more Tupac than I do to anything else.
I don't think that's terrible at all. Oh. I listen to more Tupac, Eminem, 50 Cent.
Yeah.
Dre, all that, DMX, way dude. More than any, and I have a pulse on the other things, right? Like I like Kendrick, you know, but I never really got into J. Cole, not because I don't like him as a lyricist, but like just the acoustics of his voice, superficial, right? The voice doesn't do it for me. Like, no. But yeah, I mean, I'm way more of like that school, the competitive kind of hip hop than the club hip hop.
You know, my daughters pulled up, Megan Thee Stallion. And I was like, I just find it lackluster. I think there's better stuff. And if we're going to listen to rap in the car, we're either going to listen to Tupac or something that's Eminem, Dr. Dre, kind of in that era. I mean, at the end of the day, like, I think Eminem is probably the most scary dude within that game because he just shreds people.
Yeah.
And it's great. And he just shells people. And then the fucking best part is people try to fuck with him. And he's like, no, you don't want any of this. And then he fucking murders him.
Well, and it's worse when you people weigh in on that, John, when they don't even know how to listen to hip hop. They're like, well, this song was better by so-and-so. I go, yo, do you even know how many syllables and all the things that he just hit within that and the complexity, you know, of the rhyme scheme? I mean, there are things when people don't know how to listen to hip hop and they don't hear like the syllable sound combined. No, like what, like they're either not even listening to the words, they're listening to the beats, or they're not understanding how the word. There's a great YouTube. If somebody looks up the YouTube, it's like why Eminem's the best rapper alive. And this guy goes through the rhyme scheme, yep, right? Of how he does these things. And I'm going to, hold on, I got to share this lyric. There's this one that offended. They go through the rhyme scheme, and in one of them, and this isn't going to be the song, he literally rhymes every word in each of the sentences with every part of it. You just got to watch it because the guy will, he'll break it down. But even hearing something like this, there's this song on the Revival album that got panned. And let's see, where is this? Hold on. Minimum wage. I'm going to find this and it's crazy. But like, I hate when people weigh in on who's the best. And it's like, dude, you don't know how to like listen. You don't know how to listen to these lyrics. And so here it is. Nobody likes me. 8-year-old wordplay. All right. We're almost there. We're getting a rap thing. And you're like, yeah, damn right you are. All right. So he says, now my dough's a mountain to a mountain. It's rise too high to count it. Never asked to be rich. All I wish was that I had a dime for every time I was doubted. So even looking at that, right? It rise too high to count it. I wish I had a dime for every time I was doubted. And then he goes, but then I think about it and I'm enraged because I just figured out if I was paid for the time I put, for the time I spent to put the pen to the page, it'd be minimum wage. And then he goes rapid fire and he goes, but it's embedded in my head. I never hunted for the bread and butter. What I wanted was to be the one that they were scared of, but I'm never going to get credit for the sweat and blood. But hit it and blood with bread and butter and scared of butt and harder than never. Cause, and it's like, yo, like you have to live. And that's, again, I think what made me fall in love initially with strength and conditioning is like just being able to feel like I could give somebody the simplest program and they could be like, all right, dude, like RDL paired with this and that doesn't look hard. And you're like, yeah, cause you don't understand. But once you're in set four and these exercises that look really simple are just combined together, the metabolic effect when they're done right will like, it's the beauty and simplicity. And then that's also, right, you talked about the hero's journey. My thing with communication was hanging in a hospital coach. And this is the equipment, but they're not, Dan Paff and I would talk about this, they're not watching the coaching. So they're like, what do you think about the Kaiser rack? What do you think about this? What do you think of Franz Bosch? And Dan was like, nobody ever knows what I whispered in the ear for the athlete, what I said here. And that's where him and me and Stu McMillan and all these people would nerd out. And that to me was like, all right, now I really get the hip hop and MC versus rapper shit. Rappers are the people out there in S&C that are like, good beats is the equivalent of fancy equipment and all this stuff, right? But a true MC and a lyricist is somebody that's like the simplest thing you say, the way you present yourself on the floor, the nature of the interactions, plus the simplicity of the programming and the implementation of it. Oh, you stand back and you're Dr. Dre and you've completed an opus. And to the non-discerning coach, it looks horrendously like non-sexy, boring, and they're on to like the footwork Kang and Instagram. And you're like, that's where the real people really recognize the real people. And I think a lot of this too, just to cap on that hero's journey, like why I'm so obsessed with music and part is when I was hospitalized for that year, I don't think I've ever really shared this. So new shit exclusive. You could only watch PG movies in the hospital. You couldn't read magazines or books of certain kinds because they didn't want you to have like, you know, even sports would quote unquote trigger some people and, you know, whatever, anything that was body image or this or that. So all I did was listen to music. A bunch of the other patients would sleep or they'd do this. So I would just listen to music and find ways to make sense of what I was feeling at that point in my life at 14, 15 through the words of other people expressing their angst in this. And to me, it just all culminated at some point of understanding like why music and coaching and hip hop and this and craftsmanship all came to that. Might sound horrendously ridiculous. And I know I just blacked out, but you said no, you like the in-depth. So
no, it's an incredible, I mean, the parallels that you're drawing and the way that it makes sense to you. It's elegant. It's cool. I mean, I always appreciate when somebody can pull on something else and be able to draw those parallels and be able to explain something in a different medium. So, I mean, the music stuff is always, for me personally, music's always been extremely important in that I can tie music to feelings and I can tie it to times and, like, you know, instantly it's like the world's best. It's better than a picture for me because I can remember where I was when I heard it. I can remember the moment and different pieces and like the influence that it had. And like, all of a sudden it's like music for me triggers memories a lot more than when somebody like, hey, do you remember this? And then I'll hear some music associated with that time period and be like, oh shit. Like the other day I heard, it was like on some like spot or a satellite radio. Remember the song Laffy Taffy?
Oh yeah. Yeah. D for Ronaldo.
Yeah, the Laffy. They used to play that during TV timeouts in 2006. So, like every year, like every game we went out to, literally at TV timeouts, somewhere in the third or fourth quarter, they would always play the Laffy Taffy song, and Brian Waters and like the dudes would always dance, and I just thought it was hysterical. And like I remember standing on the field and hearing the Laffy Taffy. It's like hearing "Welcome to the Jungle," which they played before every kickoff. Songs that they played Kansas City Chiefs, or, you know, songs I listened to before the game, or, you know, going to pick up Kyle Turley, listening to, you know, Raining Blood by Slayer, or the time we got to go hear Alice in Chains, play in a live deal. I mean, there's just so much music associated, or, you know, skateboarding down to go buy Led Zeppelin CDs at this UCD place. So, there's all these different time periods associated with music. And I was trying to explain it to my daughter. I remember the first time I ever heard NWA was I was riding with my brother. My brother just got his license. I was in the car with him, 14 years old, maybe 13. And that came on the radio, which blew my fucking mind to this day, that NWA Straight Outta Compton was on playing on the radio.
Straight Outta Compton, crazy named Dex.
And they like didn't bleep it. And the guy was like, I don't think we're allowed to play that. I mean, and it was like on, all the different music associated with, with time periods. And it's amazing how like songs can like trigger certain memories. And so it makes extreme sense to me, especially with the hip hop stuff. Cause I was a minority, playing in the NFL. I mean, there's not that many white dudes that do that job. So, I mean, obviously the music choices weren't necessarily like we had a deal. The strongest dude, I got to pick the music. So whenever I walked in the weight room, I just fucking always changed it. And then people would yell and I'd be like, all right, we'll pick something that you're stronger than me at. Let's fucking do it.
Let's go. Yeah.
And, but like the, I've always had a good cultural appreciation for like rap and hip hop, but like it just kind of deviated towards something where I hear it. And I don't know if that's age, because I think Tex told me that they did some research where there's a certain point in your life where you're most susceptible and then it crystallizes your choices in music.
Uh-huh. And haircuts.
And so, I always worry a little bit, like, am I too crystallized within my own time period? And then I listen to it and you're like, it's still not as good as what we heard.
Yeah. I mean, and it's interesting. First of all, I want to acknowledge you brought up something supremely relevant and impactful that it is more, for me, it's more impactful than a photograph too. And I thought about, as I was listening to you, some of the songs that you mentioned, what would that be for me? And the D Pharrell song, that reminds me of, I went to Kansas State for undergrad and I remember there's always this place that you ended the night on, for better or worse. It was either Tubby's or Porter's. Tubby's was like the place that you dance or whatever and all that. The Lean With It, Rock With It stuff was really big then. So I remember that at Tubby's. At Porter's, it would usually end with like King of Wishful Thinking by Go West or something like that. Welcome to the Jungle. It's funny. I either think of the movie, The Program. You remember that with Omar Epps?
Oh, yeah.
Or I think of, there was this really, I think it was a bad movie. I don't remember it that well, but Jim Carrey played a villain in a movie called The Deadpool.
Yeah.
And there was this scene, right? And I remember they were playing Welcome to the Jungle, but immediately. Yeah.
Clint Eastwood. Yeah.
There you go. And, Red Dirt Country. One of my ex-girlfriends got me onto that. Whenever I think of cross Canadian ragweed, or whenever I go to St. Louis, I think of cross Canadian ragweed because I remember seeing them at a concert in St. Louis. And so I'll hit a place and it's almost like, and that's probably, you know, to a degree, other than transitions and to keep audiences lively. I don't think it's a coincidence why they do that in movies. I can drive through this town called Nashville, Illinois, and the cross Canadian ragweed song Fighting For will come on in my head because I remember that played one time when I was coming back from the airport, you know, in the holidays when I worked at SIU. So yeah, it is. And I'd have to imagine almost all your listeners, if we surveyed them, would be like, if we listed five songs, they're going to be like, pop, pop, pop. Yeah.
Well, you know, the age old, like, you'll never remember what somebody says, but they'll remember how you made them feel. You know, like, fuck, that's, I'm pretty sure I've seen that at Luke Summers' house, you know, right next to Live, Love, Laugh in his kitchen. But like, so, you know, there's cheesy stuff like that. But I think what's so interesting about music, especially when you see music that becomes ageless. So, I mean, I remember I was probably 7, 8 years old riding in the back of my brother's buddy's, you know, Volkswagen Jetta, listening to Master of Puppets. And at like with blown speakers and riding in the back because we had to go somewhere. My brother was babysitting me and we got in the car with his buddy who had a license. I think he was 15. I think I was 9. And riding there listening to Master of Puppets. And when I got out, he gave me a Master of Puppets cassette that he had ripped. He had like 20 of them and he had gone and ripped them all and then was just giving them to people to try to get more people to listen to Metallica. And so I was 9 years old and I had this Metallica tape and it was the first time I ever heard it was in his car. And like to this day, I still listen to it as if this just came out. And I always think if this hit the airwaves today and was released by Metallica, it would still be a fucking hit. Like think about Led Zeppelin. I mean, any of their stuff, if you heard it today, you'd be like, ah, that's pretty good. I mean, that could play right next to Ed Sheeran, who's another extremely talented dude. I watched a story about him and Jamie Foxx, how he slept on Jamie Foxx's couch and Jamie Foxx took him to all these places. Oh, dude, there's an incredible origin story for Ed Sheeran and Jamie Foxx that he talked about on a talk show that I've watched recently. But yeah, I mean, there's like such interesting origin stories. But what I'm always searching for is like, is that music timeless? Is the first time that my daughters are 10, I play them that song. If they hear it and they're like, wow, this is pretty good. Is, you know, and they've never heard it before and they don't have any historical reference for that music. Is it timeless? Is it classic?
Mm. Yeah. Sorry, go ahead.
No, I went to a wedding on Saturday and then, you know, the couple's first dance song, that's the moment. I actually interrupted the DJ and had to remind him that we were in Texas. He was pulled from somewhere out west.
You mean California?
Yeah, that's exactly where. There's a lot of cowboy hats in the audience, not a lot of cowboys. That's what I had to tell this man. So, like, we need some country western dancing, please. So, yeah, people were out on the dance floor, but kids were taking over the dance floor. So his feeling was like, oh, there's people out here. I'm doing a good job. But the only people who were dancing were like 7-year-olds just doing crazy stuff. So then as soon as
you bring him out a little Western swing.
Yeah. As soon as he put on like dancing music, people started to dance versus just like, you know, party, have fun here.
Country DJ, and Western,
country which is and what Western. So finally the last 3 songs, people were out there to dance together and shut down the evening.
You know, I did a little bit of deep dive on the internet, and the type of music that I like is known as Western swing music. That's like Merle Haggard and a lot of that stuff.
I want to know, I need you to educate me on this. I didn't know the gentleman at the time, but I was in Amsterdam teaching a course once, and I happened to find myself in an establishment later that day sitting next to a gentleman who eventually introduced himself as Sturgill Simpson. And Sturgill was just a really nice guy. We had a good conversation for about 2.5 hours. And then I went home and was bringing up the conversation to somebody and mentioned I met this guy named Sturgill. And they go, oh my God, was this Sturgill Simpson? And apparently this guy is a huge star. Apparently he's just a massive, and I don't know what kind of music, because just like anything, there's subgenres, right? So what, if you guys are familiar with country it, or him, what subgenre would you say Sturgill Simpson is?
In singer-songwriter, because he writes and sings his own music.
Yeah.
So if you go to Nashville, there's a whole band of songwriters. And then dudes like George Strait, who are amazing singers, take their music and, you know, George Strait works his wonders. But then so we look at...
Does George Strait not write his own music?
No. So then we look at Cody Canada, the lead singer of Cross Canadian Ragweed. His whole team, now he's solo, but he's singer-songwriter. And that's more of... Yeah, and that's more of like a now an Americana.
Well, that's so, kind of that Red Dirt country.
Well, yes. And then there's an Americana wave between Oklahoma, Texas, and then uniquely like some East Coast stuff like Maryland, where there's parts of Maryland and Virginia that are redneck.
Yep.
And I love it. It's great. So it's like this interesting tune and wave of this Americana, Texas country, and then that take from the singer-songwriter. Like nothing against...
Who was the guy I brought up yesterday? The guy, we're Texas, screw you. We're from Texas.
Merle Haggard.
No. Remember we talked about it yesterday. The guy lives in Wimberley. Mm-hmm. He's like 75.
Yeah.
I can't remember his name. It's Growl. But there's a whole...
Ray Wiley Hubbard.
Yeah, Ray Wiley Hubbard. He's kind of a fixture here in Austin and, you know, lives out in Wimberley, not far from where Tex went to that wedding. And so there's all of this kind of interesting kind of Texas red dirt country singer-songwriter stuff opposed from like the stuff you hear on the radio, which is just like 25 people writing a song.
Yeah, if it's on the radio and it's labeled country, that's what kind of pisses me off, in that the people hate country music and there's this whole wave, at least of Texas country, like the cross-Canadian ragweed folks, that people, if they actually listen to, would dig.
I was that guy. I'll be honest. I mean, I liked Garth Brooks, When the Thunder Rolls and all that, but I got into hip hop and rock and alternative early and all that. But I used to hate country because the majority of country I heard was super depressing. And then, like I said, it was that woman that I dated in college that introduced me, and also a close friend of mine named Libby Hiltner, got me into cross Canadian ragweed and some of that red dirt. And I'm like Johnny Cooper, who I think is a little bit more pop now. I could name more. It's on my Spotify, but it's escaping me. But I was like, all right. And it was good Saturday, Sunday morning lifts, you know, when you're just in the garage and you have some time to kind of turn on College Game Day and you can kind of just, you've hit your main lifts that week. And so that morning, just kind of for whatever you want to do, I'd love turning on that red dirt country and just having some fun there.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's always good music to drink beer too.
Well, I do everything to it because it's the only music I listen to. You guys are talking about, this rap.
Well, time out. Maybe you should come into our world a little bit, buddy. You're sitting there saying people need to give country a chance. Come into our world.
Okay. You got it. I'll start with your playlist on Spotify or listeners following this release of this episode.
You know what's funny is on occasion when up in the gym, we'll like turn on Spotify and a playlist will just randomly pop up and I'll be listening to it and I'll be like, oh, this has to be me. I mean, this has to be my playlist because there's only one asshole I know that would pair up these music or up these different songs.
Yes. Well, I'll say this to our listeners. Brett and John will come together in Power Athlete HQ Gym for a moment in time to create a playlist and experience the apprenticeship.
I feel like his knowledge of rap and hip hop is so deep. I'm actually pretty excited because I think mine's like more peripheral. Like I always appreciated, especially, and that was a cool thing with doing the job. Like I said, being as a minority, I was always exposed to some really cool music. Like I played next to Trey Thomas, and Trey was from Florida, and there was all this like really interesting kind of like, you know, Florida rap, like this just versus kind of what was New York versus California. And I just appreciated hearing like the different subgenres based on regions. And, while a lot of it I thought was awful, a lot of it was actually pretty good. You know, I remember the first time I heard Outkast, Bombs Over Baghdad.
Mm. Yep.
Dude, that fucking, we almost literally, our locker room almost exploded. Like people were fucking going crazy, kicking in lockers, going nuts. And I was like, holy shit, Outkast, Bombs Over Baghdad. Still a great fucking song.
Yeah.
Aside from an excellent exposure to rap music coming up in our event in March, what else will people take away, Brett?
From the event in March? Yeah, well, you know, I remember a friend of mine, Michael Silbernagel, was like, tell me how it would help me keep my job. And I go, it's pretty simple, man. Communications is the one thing in life guaranteed to make your life either better or worse, depending on how you do at it, right? Like, and so the whole thing is, I understand text. Nobody wakes up and is like, oh my God, I want to be a better communicator. But people do wake up and say, I don't want to waste as much time. I want to get more done. I want to build more trust and I want to deal with less trauma. And that's essentially what this stuff is about, right? It is It is a deep dive, all backed in research, but also heavily applied into how you can understand how to play the game of different social situations around you. Whether you're a strength coach at a university that's trying to get funding for something, or you're somebody that's a nurse and you deal with Becky, just some ass hat at work, or what, everybody's got situations they deal with in life. I mean, we had a strength coach recently that came to one of ours that, you know, they just had an issue with their father there, you know, and I don't want to get too into it because I want to like protect their privacy. We've had firefighters that need to work better with certain teams. We've had SWAT officers. So anybody that's ever like felt like, hey, I'm trying to do really well at what I do, but I either have some issues with conflict, I need to be a better negotiator, I'm just not confident, I freeze up. These are the things for you. The bottom line is it's a chance for people to be able to rehearse and refine for some of the biggest moments in their life. And we often get the question now, like, hey, is this just for extroverts? Is this for this? Is this for people that are already good communicators? No, this is for people that by and large, you know, yes, you can be skilled, but people that just kind of freeze up, or they want to kind of, I think one gentleman that worked in the Premier League of rugby in the UK came to ours and he goes, dude, I was just ready for the hard stuff. He goes, I appreciate sets and reps and there's nothing against that, but I've, you know, what I know is kind of what, you know, most of our guys are not advanced trainees and we have kind of our programs built out to like, the advanced methods aren't going to get much crazier. He goes, but what I deal with is argumentative people on the medical side. What I deal with is GMs that don't understand this. So I don't really know how to market something that everybody should intuitively know is a huge pain in all of our asses, you know? And I think that sometimes if I have to get critical with people, it's like, I hear people say, I'm a lifelong learner, I'm a coach. I'm like, well, are you really doing everything you can to improve? 96% of Con Ed and coaching space is spent on technical stuff. And it's really hard for people to level up if they stay in their comfort zone all the time. So if you want a quantitative analysis of a qualitative experience, you want to connect with other people and you're kind of cool just getting into divergent thinking, different conversations, collaborations, and learning more about social science and human behavior and what makes us do the weird things we do and how we can get better at it, come. Nobody's trying to pick you apart in a negative way. I think the other biggest selling point, man, is it's a play. It's a really cool place for people to come make mistakes. I don't feel like there's a lot of workshops, sans your guys and maybe a couple others, where it's like mistakes are encouraged. You know, a lot of times coaches kind of have to flex and puff up their chest and, you know, they're really worried about getting involved in practicals. This is something where day one, we make it clear. This isn't a game to be won. Like that's the nature of improv. You in situations where like, there's no winning. You just got to adapt. You can't, you got to laugh at your, you got to do these things. And so it's just fun, educational, but also something that allows them to laugh at themselves. And then something they can take back at their team and say, hey, we actually have this rubric where we can now grade this and we can use it when we're doing Zoom calls, when we're doing real coaching, when I'm giving a presentation, when I'm talking to my wife, like you can go back and evaluate this stuff. And yeah, I could keep going, man, but at the end of the day, the people who this is for know it, and the people that it's not for have quit listening to our conversation 30 minutes ago, you know?
No, it sounds cool. I was fortunate 2 weeks ago to go to, Craig Douglas, who we had on the podcast, who's a ex-cop and teaches a bunch of combative stuff. We had him on the podcast, and he's like, hey, you should come to one of my courses. And one of my things is that if we have somebody on and they invite me to a course, I do my best to always be there. And so he hit me up a couple of days before and said, hey, we're having a course in Austin. Would you come? Great. What do I need? You need a mouthpiece and a cup and a gun and 200 rounds. I was like, all right, I'll show up.
Yep.
So it starts Friday night and I have no fucking idea what I'm getting myself into. And I have a whole bunch of, I got shot with a bunch of Sims, which is kind of even more funny. But Friday night was pretty wild in that it was about basically like situational awareness. And how to like engage people and just like how to read and basically everything that I picked up being a bouncer on like how to like gauge where people are being hostile, closing distance, how to like, you know, like just a bunch of shit that you should invariably know on like if you're going to navigate a bar or, you know, real life situation on how to not get your ass kicked. Yeah. And more importantly, if you feel like you're going to get your ass kicked on how to like make moves to make sure it not happen. I call it street smarts. And it was pretty interesting.
Street smarts.
When I was a college football player, we were so broke and so far below the poverty line that I had a job working security for these illegal raves in San Francisco.
What?
And then I got to work. Yeah, I used to like like illegal, like renting out warehouses, bring in like illegal warehouses, drugs, kids, glow sticks, dancing, ecstasy, the whole deal. And I used to work security and work the door for these illegal raves. And then I worked at some legit clubs too. But I learned a lot about like being able to spot bad guys, situational awareness, you know, like just observing things. And it was funny as we got into the course, it was funny because Craig's like, oh, you're pretty good at disarming. I'm like, well, I've had to avoid a lot of fights because at the end of the day, I don't want to get in trouble and I don't want to give people money. So it was just pretty interesting that like a lot of people really struggle because they haven't put themselves in these situations. So the long bewinded point or overly winded point that I'm trying to get to is when people come to your course and you're teaching them all of these different techniques in this, is there anything that you recommend for them to do to continue to push outside their comfort zone?
Like once they're done,
you know, you always hear people, yeah, like improv or, you know, get up and go to an open mic at a comedy store or a Toastmasters or just anything. I mean, work security, go work at a homeless shelter. I'm just wondering about like, you know, these were some of the, you know, recommendations Craig made to help people be more comfortable in these situations. I wonder within your stuff, because we're such in this like Zoom video age where, you know, like if you were sitting before, I feel like we're having a good conversation, but the conversation would be so much more rich in person.
Oh yeah. So I mean, and we cover that, right? We cover things like media richness and why certain people don't change and all that. But just to answer this briefly, and then I got to get across town is, yes, we do three levels. It's kind of like, think of it like movement programming, John, right? Like you can teach somebody a body weight squat, then you can load it with a kettlebell, then eventually you can get to bands and chains and accentuated eccentrics and all that. We start people off with like adaptive improv. So it's like, you know, it's more abstract. These are kind of adapted theater games, but they always teach an underlying skill, right? Like listening or being able to build off the narrative of somebody else. But then we do tactical role playing where this is like, I'm asking boss for a raise. I'm having a breakup. I'm whatever the real stuff you deal with in the world outside your window is. And then the third tier of that, our example of like accentuated eccentrics and bands and chains and any of that, is then we'll add additional constraints and text. It's changed a lot since you've come. So you'll see it. But we video it and we also give them this rubric. And so certain people, depending on which, you know, tier they sign up for, and every tier is 1.8 CEUs and all this, but you know, we always encourage people through this field guide, like, hey, continue to videotape yourself, use this evaluation. The more you can videotape yourself, the more you can kind of use these things. I use them in my job. When I first did this, I would have the rubric next to my desk and I'd be like, okay, how did I do with the orchestration category? How did I do with my use of questions? How did I do with this category? Which influence tactics did I use to explain things? Did I always use logic or rational persuasion, or did I use some ingratiation techniques? Some of this is going to be, you know, foreign to anybody that's not initiated on this. But when they leave, the biggest thing that they have, John, is a language, a new language to talk about these things and analyze, as opposed to being like, my verbals and nonverbals were good. Oh, John was crossing his arms, so I use mimicry to cross my arms. Like, that's so superficial, right? That's a saying, like, you're fit because you have muscles. So the biggest thing is we give them a language. We give them post-session strategy calls. And we do a lot of kind of follow-up strategy work. So we'll walk people through the material of how they can continue to utilize it, so it actually has Monday morning value.
Copy. Cool. No, man, it sounds like a great course, dude. We're excited. I mean, Tex has mentioned it to me at least every single day for the last
month. Well, one thing I want to tell you guys before I hop off is like, thank you for being good hosts. You know, we really try to do something to make this financially feasible for people. And obviously, like, I can't just leave my house and my family and teach a 20-hour workshop for like free, right? And so we have to price this, and it's extremely competitive price. Like, we give more than 1,000 hours of free content away a year. I'm beyond the point now where I'm ever going to apologize about charging for what I do. It's our job. But sometimes what we did is like with these hosts, like, you know, we ask them, hey, you know, we'll come and we'll waive your fee if you can help with signups and market to your target market. And man, everybody's well-intentioned, but some people, like, all of a sudden there's a month out and they're like, oh, could you do a post on this? Could you do a post on that? And we're like, it's just very hard to find good hosts that are accountable, that are mature. And you guys have sold this out in like record pace. And I just want to thank you. Like, it just shows your professionalism and your decorum and everything.
Well, you got to remember, we have taught collectively well over 300
seminars. But that's what I mean. You're just like
around the globe,
yeah, get it.
And have dealt with this exact science where, what do you mean? I have to do something like what we call the baby bird, where it's like, hey, man, like here's how you sell it. This is how you push it, right? Like if we can get a packed house, it's going to be a great time. And then we have people that would do fuck all. And then you show up and they would always like give you this look like, well, I didn't really push it. And we're like, oh, no, we can tell that you did nothing.
Yeah.
And they're like, well, I'm like, no, you didn't, because we would have seen something.
We like, put one post on Instagram. You're like, yeah, because everybody goes on Instagram to just sign up for like, yeah. And we could go on. We'll talk about that offline. But I just want to convey thanks and respect towards that.
Awesome. No, I mean, I really think, and this is, if anything is positive coming out of this COVID environment and all this other stuff, I really believe that the in-person seminar is making a comeback. I think it was kind of dead there for a little bit because CrossFit just beat it like a dead horse. Mm-hmm. But I really think it's starting to come back. And having gone to Craig's seminar, it was actually very fulfilling and like refilling for me to see people and see somebody teach and like to see these kind of like transformations take place. And I think we saw that every weekend and I loved it. And, there's no way to replicate that through a Zoom or a video. I mean, like all these people that are like following training programs and people with Zoom and video and through a TV and a screen. It's so fucking sterile. And no, dude, I'm stoked you're coming. And I think it's going to be a hell of an event. So we're glad to have supported it. And thanks for Tex for making it happen.
Likewise, guys.
Yeah. It is the second most impactful weekend seminar I've been CrossFit Football numero uno.
Ooh.
So wanted to help old pal out and then Empower Power Athlete Nation. A lot of Block One signed up.
Yeah, no, I mean we had JL with RPR
Holdsmith.
Yeah, and that was sold pretty well. And it also helps to have your own private facility.
Yeah, and I got a cool vision, and we'll work with Brett on that. And then we have the practicals up in our space, and then our education down here in our
office. Yeah, and now to share this, and then I really got a joke, or I'm gonna get yelled at. We're working on something again exclusive for you guys. Based on the respect that we have for you, we're working on something where I'll say it this, we're working on facilitating a compound of our own, acquiring one. And I want you to know that carte blanche, anytime you want to run anything you want to do, this is out in the rural countryside, out in the cut. Cause we do things that are kind of intimate, right? Like we're not trying to do the big mega conference. And I just want you to know, you always have a second home with us.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it. We'll probably take you up on that.
All right, guys.
Yes.
I got to run. I appreciate it.
Yes. All right.
Thanks.
Artofcoaching.com.
Artofcoaching.com. If you're interested, Art in the workshops, artofcoaching.com/apprenticeship. Artofcoaching.com is everything. We really try to make the customer journey very easy, that's always the best way to reach out to me. My social media is linked there. Everything's linked there. And that's where it is. We'll make sure and send you guys anything you need. We have tons of free resources for people out there that are new, young, old, young, whatever in the profession. So we're a small business. Check us out. We're the people on Main Street just trying to do good. There's no evil agenda here.
And on that note, thanks for tuning in to another episode of Power Athlete Radio.
Hi, guys.
Now it's time for you to empower your performance. You can find Coach Brett Bartholomew at Coach_BrettB. Until next time, bye!
Did you know using your browser in incognito mode doesn't actually protect your privacy? Take back your privacy with IPVanish VPN. Just one tap and all your data, passwords, communications, browsing history, and more will be instantly protected. IPVanish makes you virtually invisible online. Use IPVanish on all your devices, anytime you go online at home, and especially on public Wi-Fi. Get IPVanish now for 70% off a yearly plan with this exclusive offer at IPVanish.com/audio.